Welcome to today's reading of the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
This is Dave, and I'm reading from the Midland Reporter Telegram, Tuesday, May 17th. This is Section A, the front page. The headline reads, NWS, expect temps of 100 degrees. Average temperature on track to be third warmest in May in Midland history, by the Midland Reporter Telegram. It's hot. No, really hot. The National Weather Service reported a high temperature of 101 degrees on Monday. It was the third straight 100-degree day and the fifth this month. The 101-degree high temperature wasn't a record breaker for May 16th in Midland, but it is the third of six straight 100-degree days, the NWS predicted on its website. The high temperatures through Thursday are expected to range from 101 to 103 degrees. Those are 12 to 15 degrees higher than the average daily high temperatures for the middle of May. The NWS also reported on its website that the average temperature this month is on track to be the third warmest May in Midland history. The hot temperatures will dry out a region going through one of its worst nine-month droughts in its history. The National Weather Service reported Saturday that 0.57 inch of rain has fallen since September 1st. The NWS reports that the average precipitation from September 1st through May 14th in Midland is 7.59 inches. There is no rainfall expected in the NWS's seven-day forecast. In fact, the best chance for a break from the status quo will come Saturday, when cooler temperatures are expected. The NWS shows a high temperature of 83 degrees Saturday and 85 degrees Sunday. This article is entitled, TTU HSC Officials Show Off Physician Assistant Program Building Expansion, by the Midland Reporter Telegram. There was a ribbon-cutting Monday for the Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center's $30 million School of Health Professions Physician Assistant Program expansion at Midland College. State Representative Tom Craddock, Republican Midland, secured $20 million in 2019 from the 86th Texas Legislature, and community partners provided additional support. Midland Development Corporation, $5 million, Permian Strategic Partnership, $2.5 million, and the Scarborough Foundation, $1 million, and the Henry Foundation, $100,000. The additional $1.5 million comes from other gift funding and TTU HSC institutional funds. We are grateful for the generosity of our community partners and the state legislature whose support made this expansion possible, TTU HSC President Lori Rice Spearman, Ph.D., said in a press release. The state-of-the-art facilities it brings marks a milestone for our physician assistant program and will help transform healthcare in this region. Not only does the additional space allow us to accept more of the qualified students who apply to the program, but the new facilities allow students to remain in the community for all aspects of their classroom coursework. The end result is an opportunity to retain more physician assistants in the region, enhancing access to care and filling critical shortages in areas including primary care. The 32,500-square-foot facility will include an anatomy lab, clinical classrooms, and training facilities. The labs will be available for nursing students as well as healthcare professionals throughout the Permian Basin. The expansion will allow PA class size to increase from 60 to 72 students in the next 3 years. In 2019, officials reported that three-quarters of the 160 physician assistants in the Permian Basin were Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center alums. Physician assistants make great health care possible, State Representative Tom Craddock said during a groundbreaking event in 2019. This article is entitled, Permian Basin Gives. Fundraising goal for today's one-day event is $1.459 million, by Stuart Doreen. Today is a big day for giving in Midland and the Permian Basin. Permian Basin Gives, a one-day event encouraging residents to create meaningful impact through nonprofits that serve the region, will take place Tuesday. The fundraising goal is $1.459 million. Permian Basin Gives started in 2020, at a time when nonprofits were having to cancel or postpone their fundraising events, Lori Johnson, executive director of the Nonprofit Management Center, wrote. Permian Basin Gives is the result of several nonprofit executive directors brainstorming about how to replace that lost revenue. Since its inception, the annual Day of Giving has generated $3.8 million in donations to our area nonprofits. Johnson stated 117 nonprofits are participating in this year's event. She also said that the Permian Basin Gives online initiative has brought nonprofits together to support each other by sharing the same website, permianbasingives.org, which allows donors to find out about other nonprofits. When donors visit the website, they select each organization that they want to support and can also research other nonprofits, Johnson said. By working together during Permian Basin Gives, everyone is a winner. Kay Kreitz, executive director of Big Brothers Big Sisters, told the Reporter Telegram in an email that Permian Basin Gives has resulted in donations of almost $40,000 to Big Brothers Big Sisters over the past 2 years. This is money that can be used to conduct background checks on volunteers to help ensure the safety of children in our program and to hold activities to help volunteers and children bond, Kreitz wrote in an email. It can also be used for more mundane yet essential expenses such as postage and utilities. In addition, Permian Basin Gives has allowed organizations to create new individual connections in the communities for both future donations and possible volunteers, she said. Permian Basin Gives has brought in millions of dollars to help our local agencies thrive and fulfill their missions to support our communities, Kreitz wrote. This funding has been a lifeline during the past 2 years when fundraisers have been canceled and people's attention has been focused on other matters. Autumn West of Midland Shared Spaces noted that even with $100 oil, many in Midland and across the region are feeling the effects of inflation, which Bloomberg recently reported is as bad in Midland as just about any other place in the country. Now, more than ever, every dollar has the power to make a difference for a nonprofit, Vest wrote. Nonprofits provide critical community services and touch our lives through emergency response services, health and wellness programs, education, entertainment, and more. Permian Basin Gives is a day about the individual donation and the ability to be reminded about other opportunities in the nonprofit sector. With nearly $4 million in donations over 2 years, it has been a nice complement to foundation donations and efforts by individual organizations. Every day, Midland nonprofits make a difference for you and your neighbors, Mark Palmer, executive director of the Abel Hanger Foundation, reported. Help them continue to make that difference. This article is entitled, OPEC Plus, pumping more oil won't ease gas prices. Partners likely to continue to raise output quotas by 432K barrels a month. By Anthony DiPaola and Verity Ratcliffe, Bloomberg. Saudi Arabia's energy minister said a dearth of refining capacity meant that gasoline and other oil products would remain expensive, even if the world's biggest exporters pumped more crude. Prince Abdulaziz bin Salman's reiteration that there are physical impediments that no producer can solve comes as spiking gasoline and diesel compound inflationary pressures that are worsening a global cost of living crisis. At the same time, the determination of OPEC Plus to stick to modest supply increases, despite flows from coalition member Russia being disrupted by an international boycott, has drawn the ire of U.S. lawmakers. There is no refining capacity commensurate with the current demand and the expectation of the demand in the summer, the minister said at an energy conference in Bahrain on Monday. Prince Abdulaziz's comments were echoed by Bahrain's oil minister, Sheikh Mohammed bin Khalifa bin Ahmad, who said the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries and its partners are likely to continue to raise output quotas by 432,000 barrels a month. There's no new capacity coming, he said at the same event. Even if you produce more crude, there isn't demand for it. There aren't any more refineries. Fuel prices have surged as efforts to isolate Russia, one of Europe's most important suppliers, upend international markets. Soaring demand ahead of the peak U.S. driving season is sending refining margins to extraordinary heights, benefiting refineries, including Saudi Aramco. OPEC Plus is achieving market balance in its best performance in maybe more than 50 years, Iraqi oil minister Ihsan Abdul Jabbar said in Bahrain. This is the obituary column. Tuesday, May 17th. Auden Medina Gamino. Auden Medina Gamino, 39 years old of Midland, passed away on May 11th following an oilfield work accident in Stanton. He was born on March 1st, 1983, to Santiago and Antonio in La Estancia, León, Guanajuato. He is survived by his wife of 13 years, Nazaria Montes López, his daughter Ruby, 12 years old, his three sons, Santiago, José, Pepito, and Fabian, and his mother, Antonio Gamino, as well as many brothers and sisters. He is preceded in death by his father, Santiago Gamino. Funeral mass is set for Tuesday, May 17th at 2 p.m. at San Miguel Archangel Catholic Church. Burial will follow at Serenity Memorial Gardens. Funeral service is under the direction of Heavenly Gate Funeral Home. Family messages and condolences may be emailed to pipkin@nts-online.net, or you can visit our website at www.heavenlygatefh.com. Donna Sue Myers. Donna Sue Myers went to be with our Heavenly Father on May 7th. She was born in St. Joseph, Missouri on October 6, 1949, to Everett and Lola Tibbetts. Donna is survived by her daughter Kelly Ridgway, husband Tim Ridgway, Shelley Mixon brother-in-law, Mark Myers, as well as five grandchildren and 11 great-grandchildren. Two sisters, Karen Walker and husband Johnny from St. Joseph, Missouri, Barbara Spartan and husband Dick from Denton, Texas, also many nieces and nephews. Donna is preceded in death by her mother, Lola Tibbetts, and her dad, Everett Tibbetts. James Walter Eastup, Jr. James Walter Eastup, Jr. of Granbury went to his eternal home on May 11th at the age of 67. He entered this world on November 8, 1954, in Amarillo, ready for an adventurous lifestyle. Jim was preceded in death by his grandparents and his parents, James Walter Estep Sr. and Pat Estep. Jim is survived by his wife Charlotte, son James Walter Estep III, and wife Danielle of Wilmington, North Carolina, three stepdaughters, Brandy Gillette and husband Robert of Tomball, Bridget Thomas and husband Chris of Midland, Jessica Dorchak and husband Matthew of Keller, as well as eight grandchildren. His celebration of life will be at First Baptist Church, Granbury, on Friday, May 20th at 3 p.m. A second celebration of life will be held in Midland at Fannin Terrace Baptist Church on Saturday, May 21st. In lieu of flowers, please consider donations to St. Jude's, First Presbyterian Church in Midland, First Baptist Church in Granbury, or adopting a child through Compassion International. Philip Daniel Friday. Philip Daniel Friday, 39, of Midland, passed away on Friday, May 13th. A rosary will be held at 7 p.m. on Wednesday, May 18th, and a memorial mass will be held at 10 a.m. on Thursday, May 19th, both at St. Anne's Catholic Church. Philip was born on July 7th, 1982, in Midland, to Ellen and Lance Friday. Philip is survived by his parents, Ellen and Lance Friday, his brothers and their families, Michael Friday and wife Amanda, Mark Friday and his wife Jordan. Also leaves behind his grandfather, George Daniel Friday, as well as many aunts, uncles, and cousins. Philip is preceded in death by his maternal grandparents, Phil and Josie Rocha, and his paternal grandmother, Melba Jean Friday. Arrangements are under the direction of Nally Picklin Wells Funeral Home. Online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com. Sergio H. Rendon. Sergio H. Rendon, 65, of Midland, left this world and entered heaven on May 12th. He passed away peacefully in his home surrounded by his loved ones. Sergio was born in Uvalde, Texas, to Guadalupe and Feliciano Rendon. He is preceded in death by his parents Guadalupe and Felicia Rendon, sister Elva Davila, and brother Guadalupe Rendon, Jr. He is survived by his wife Diana Casanova Rendon, children Clarissa Platt, Eric, Stacy Rendon, Elizabeth Hudek, Michael, Andrea Zorbas, Jesse, Alexis Ormond, Justin, and A.J. Archuleta Casanova. He is also survived by brothers and sisters and grandchildren and numerous nieces and nephews. A wake was held from 6 to 8 p.m. Sunday, May 15th at Nally Picklin Wells Funeral Home. Funeral services were held at 10 a.m. Monday, May 16th. Burial followed at Rest Haven Memorial Park. Online condolences can be made at www.npwelch.com. This article is entitled Early College Student on Way to Cornell University by Rebecca Bell. Editor's note, funding provided through Permian Basin Gives Day helps pay Midland College tuition costs for Caleb Goylandeau and other students attending Early College High School at Midland College. On July 17th, Caleb Goylandeau will be 18 years old. However, before then, he will graduate from Midland College with an associate degree on May 13th, then receive his high school diploma from Early College High School at Midland College, ECHS at MC, on May 20th. In mid-August, he will travel to Cornell University in Ithaca, New York, where he will major in biological sciences on a pre-med track. People often ask me why I chose Cornell, Goylandeau said. The main reason is that it's an Ivy League school with a great reputation, but also I have relatives living in that area. I applied to Cornell and several schools in Texas. I was also accepted into the University of Texas, Austin, but I've always wanted to go to Cornell. When I received the acceptance letter a few months ago, I wasn't sure we could make it work financially. Thankfully, I will receive several scholarships. Cornell will provide me with networking connections and research opportunities surrounded by other scholars who take an interest in developing themselves. Guilan Do is one of the top five students in the graduating class of ECHS at MC. He has been attending the Accelerated High School located on the Midland College main campus since the beginning of his 10th grade year. I applied to ECHS at MC when I was in the 8th grade at Goddard Junior High, he explained. That year I was denied acceptance, but I was determined to get into the program. I loved the idea of being academically challenged. After hearing about ECHS at MC and how I could get both a high school diploma and a college degree at the same time, I knew that was the program for me. So, the next year, while I was a 9th grader at Midland Freshman School, I applied again as a transfer student. Thankfully, I was accepted as a sophomore. Guilan Do said that he has not regretted his decision for a minute. "I love the fast-paced environment," he exclaimed. "It's also given me an opportunity to make friends outside of just my age group. Through my college courses, I participated in learning teams and discussion groups with traditional age college students as well as adults. After I got over my intimidation of being the youngest in the group, I found that we all work well together. Because of where we are in life, we have different outlooks, but that just makes our discussions more interesting." ECHS at MC is a 4-year high school partnership between the Midland Independent School District and Midland College. Because of an accelerated curriculum, students have the opportunity to graduate high school with an associate degree and enter college ready for a bachelor's degree program. There is no cost for students to attend ECHS at MC. Midland College offers a full scholarship to all students, so that they do not have to pay college tuition. Scholarship funding is provided through community donations, and each year Midland College directs all funds received through Permian Basin Gives Day to the ECHS at MC scholarship. ECH at MC is ranked among the best high schools in Texas and is considered number one in the Midland metropolitan area, according to U.S. News and World Report. According to the rankings, ECHS at MC sits at number 195 among the state's thousands of high schools. Early College High School at Midland College also ranked among the top 40% of schools nationwide. One might think that with those rankings, ECHS at MC accepts only students in an elite privilege category. However, that is not the case at all. Minority enrollment at ECHS is 87%, and 49% are economically disadvantaged. "It hasn't always been easy, but I am so thankful for the opportunities I've had in the program, especially being able to take college courses from college professors," Guilan Do said. "The ECHS at MC curriculum has pushed me to do my best, to do something different than just getting a high school diploma. I've learned how to use resources, improve time management skills, and refine my personal values." Guilan Do has also proven to be a student leader, not just at the high school level, but also at the collegiate level. This past year, he was an officer in MC's Phi Theta Kappa PTK Honor Society and was instrumental in coordinating a student-produced podcast at Midland College. "I remember my first PTK meetings," he recalled. "I sat in and ate the free food. Then in one meeting, Dr. Terry Gilmore, MC government professor and PTK advisory, talked about creating a podcast for Midland College. Being a podcast enthusiast, I immediately talked to her about it. A few weeks later, I became the vice president of leadership and oversaw the Midland College podcast. The podcast was a way to showcase all students at MC, ECHS and honor students, as well as non-traditional students, those who were older and coming back to get skills training or upgrade current skills. Through PTK, I also met my best friend Anna, who attends a community college in the Dallas area. PTK gave me connections that I wouldn't have had otherwise. Goylando is an only child. His father, Sebastian Goylando, was in the U.S. Army, and Caleb was born on a military base in Italy. When he was 2 years old, his father was transferred to Fort Hood in Killeen. His parents later divorced, and Caleb moved to Midland with his mother, April Franco. He attended Midland Independent School District elementary schools, Anson Jones Elementary, Bush Elementary, and Washington STEM Academy. When I was a freshman in high school, I picked up a book in the Midland Freshman School Library entitled The Hot Zone by Richard Preston, Goylando said. It's a true story about an Ebola virus outbreak. The book sparked my interest in infectious diseases, even before the COVID pandemic. Right now, my goal is to pursue my interest in infectious diseases, probably through medical school, when I graduate from Cornell. In addition to a medical degree, I'm also interested in pursuing a PhD. In his spare time, Goylando enjoys playing tennis and playing the violin. On Friday evening, Goylando was the selected student speaker at Midland College's graduation ceremony. During his speech, Caleb addressed his fellow Midland College graduates and said, "While the world doubted you, you kept on running. While you went through the challenges of Midland College, you kept on dreaming. You looked at your future, you looked at your life and said, 'I see the future I want, and I am going to get there.'" At the close of the interview for this article, Caleb Goylando remarked, "I have had an amazing experience at ECHS at MC. Thank you for the opportunity to study at Midland College and be the highest achieving student I can be." Rebecca Bell is the Executive Director of Institutional Advancement at Midland College. This is the opinion page. This column is called Commentary. Beware those who aren't educated about the tax rate. By Stuart Doreen, staff columnist. Beware those who don't know the difference between the tax rate and tax collections. The other day I received a mailer. It referenced a governmental entity that supposedly cut taxes in half over a 20-year period. I read it thinking, cool, way to go. But a second look at the information provided made me realize this was another example of someone getting tax rate and tax collection mixed up. Budget season is coming up again, and people are going to hear about tax rates and tax collections. You are going to hear a few politicians talk about lowering the tax rate, or low tax rates in general, and thinking they have been good fiscal stewards on that alone. Some do this because they know there are people in the community who do not know the difference. Here is Budget 101 in a nutshell. An entity determines generally how much it wants to spend on a given year. The entity then gets the valuations estimate from the appraisal district and puts that number in the formula to determine a tax rate. If the tax rate is too high, the budget is cut. If it is low, there is the option to spend more. Every once in a while, you will hear someone say that valuations are the reason that taxes increased or decreased. The problem with that is they have the valuations before determining the tax rate. In Midland, I think this is a fair assessment. Our valuations have skyrocketed over the last 20 years or so. A $100,000 house in 2003 could be put on the market today for more than $250,000. We have artificially high housing costs in Midland. That is part of life here. And one reason I don't care for politicians who focus on the tax rate is the message they are sending the electorate. The tax rate is not the only thing that matters.
And someday, whether in 5 or 20 years, a bubble will burst, and the median valuation of a home in Midland will trend lower. That will send tax rates in the other direction, and there is very little that any politician can do about it. Here's another thing to remember. The example used at the beginning, that this taxing entity had cut taxes, confuses residents about tax rate and the collection. The collection, not the rate, is what we pay. And in the case of our local entities, there are not any entities with a 50% lower tax collection per capita. Again, beware the person who talks about only the tax rate. He or she is not telling the entire story. They are, possibly intentionally, distracting you from their actions in creating an oversized budget or putting up the facade of fiscal conservatism when they were just in office at a time of unprecedented valuations increases. If you want the budget, fine, say so and move on. If you don't, and believe the size of a budget puts a hardship on the taxpayer, vote against it and recommend cuts. But in most cases, the budget requires a certain tax rate, and no entity's tax collection is 50% of what it was 5, 10, or 20 years ago. It's frankly not possible. And beware those who tell you otherwise. This is the Dear Abby column. Hospice volunteer stunned by family's generous gift. Dear Abby, for a few years I volunteered to tend to an elderly woman through a hospice organization. My role was to visit with her while her son ran errands or enjoyed an evening of entertainment. I grew fond of her and her family. For my 70th birthday, her daughter, son, and daughter-in-law hosted an at-home dinner in my honor. It was good fun. In addition to a tasty dinner and homemade birthday cake, there were presents, wine, gag wine glass, and a birthday card with a gift card enclosed. The wine is long gone, and I have used the wine glass ever since. I left the gift card in the birthday card and set it aside. I recently wanted to buy a $20 coffee mug online, so I pulled out the gift card and was shocked to see the value of the card is almost 4 times more than the mug I fancied. I feel the gift is too much. How do I gracefully return the very generous gift? Signed, Overwhelmed in Washington. Dear Overwhelmed, your heart is in the right place, but please do not reject that family's gift of gratitude for what you did for their mother and for them during a difficult time. To do otherwise would be a breach of etiquette. Your acts of kindness are worth every penny, and you are deserving of what was given to you. Dear Abby, my husband of 55 years never talks to me anymore. Unless I initiate conversation, he sits in silence, staring off into space. He says he has nothing to say. It drives me crazy. I suppose after all these years, anything he says has been said before, but still, it leaves me feeling lonely and unloved. When I tell him how it makes me feel, he says it isn't the case, but he never changes. We don't have TV, and I can read or do crossword puzzles by myself for just so long. I really look forward to the evening when I can start drinking my whiskey so I have a little pleasure in my life. I don't have more than a couple of drinks because I understand the health risks, but tell me, what else can I do? Signed, Talking to Myself in Texas. Dear Talking, what you can do is quit drinking to ease your loneliness and get out of the house. Socialize with others at least once a week. Look into opportunities to volunteer in your community. Take your husband with you if you can pry him out of his chair. The only thing you should not do is continue on the path you're on. P.S. If your husband's passivity is new behavior, consider going with him to the doctor so he can be screened for depression. While you're there, it might not be a bad idea for you to be screened for it as well. Dear Abby, this is not a big drama, but I think that if someone wants to give out my email address, they should first ask me for permission. I just received an email from an acquaintance telling me they had given out my email and then asking me if that was okay. No, it wasn't. Abby, I'm not in witness protection, but my email address is private. Am I crazy? Signed, Cranky on Long Island. Dear Cranky, crazy? Not at all. What your nervy acquaintance did was breach whatever privacy is left in our society these days, which was thoughtless, rude, and inexcusable. You can write to Dear Abby at dearabby.com or P.O. Box 69440, Los Angeles, California, 90069. Her column is distributed by Universal Press Syndicate.
This is Jane, reading for the Odessa American. Apple has been displaced as the most valuable company in the world. It is now Saudi Arabia's Aramco. What a difference a few months make. Here is the box score on major indice declines since their November through January highs. The DJIA down 14.8%. SPX down 18.75%. NASD down 32%. The tech-heavy NASD led the way up, soaring to 16,750. The decline erases the entire advance from November 2020 to the high a year later. A one-third loss in 6 months is certainly heralding the bear market we have been discussing. There are precedents for what is happening. From the NASD high of 5,000 in March 2000, the index fell to 3,000 in just 3 months. It rebounded 61% of the fall to 4,250 and then spent over 2 years sinking to 1,250. That erased 75% of the high. The 1929 experience was similar. A big drop occurred from the October high of 390 based on the DJIA to 198 by November 13, 1929. A rebound carried to 294.07 by April of 1930. It then began a slow collapse into July 8, 1932 at a mere 41.22. The decline in the industrials took out the February lows this year. That suggests we have seen the final highs in most indices. A rebound as in 2000 and 1930 should take us into the fall of 2022. The markets are quite oversold. The percent of NASD stocks over their 50-day moving averages has plunged to 7.9%. So 92% are below that measure. The same is true now. I count 10 columns of new lows. This week, there were 27 new highs and over 2,700 new lows. That is a factor of 100 times to 1. Wow. Bear markets wipe out the excesses of the previous bull market. That is starting in the murky cryptocurrency markets. Losses run to the billions, yet El Salvador continues to cling to Bitcoin as its legal tender. Speaking of which, we now learn the U.S. government is distributing drug gear, including crack pipes. $18 million worth of meth was just seized at the border. The administration reaction is to lift Article 42, which will increase border crossings. The latest response to record high in all things energy is to halt offshore lease sales in Alaska, drawing criticism from that industry. Bull markets float higher on the positive mood. Negative mood is on the rise. For the first time in U.S. history, the Supreme Court is surrounded by a fence. Shoplifting is apparently legal in California. Monstrous is the latest horror movie release. The Ukraine war began at the lowest point of the Russian stock market since 2008. Use the upcoming rally to lighten up your holdings. It may be the last opportunity for some time. from The Economist. Double whammy. Things are tough for anyone trying to purchase a house, with a double whammy of rising prices and increasing interest rates. Inventories are very low, and supply chain issues and labor shortages continue to complicate construction. The past couple of years have seen median sales prices of existing homes jump by close to $100,000 in many Texas markets. Costs of existing homes had been rising fairly steadily for almost a decade before the pandemic. As COVID-19 increased remote work options and the need for additional space in homes for work and school, many people started looking to buy. Stimulus packages increased available cash, further fueling demand, while monetary policy moves to stabilize the economy pushed interest rates to historic lows. The result was a steep increase in housing prices as demand far outstripped supply. Over the past few months, typical mortgage rates have jumped from less than 3% to well over 5%, quite modest by historical standards, but substantially above recent experience. Although the Federal Reserve doesn't directly control mortgage rates, tightening policy by reducing security purchases and raising the federal funds rate target generally signals other rates to rise. There is little doubt that Fed action is necessitated by inflation, but it also assures that borrowers will face higher costs. Although there are many factors involved in individual loans, the change in mortgage rates is clearly affecting Texas home buyers. For every percentage point the interest rate rises, monthly payments jump about $60 per $100,000 in loan value on a 30-year note. In the Austin area, for example, where the median sales price in March was over $520,000, the 2 percentage point increase we've seen since the beginning of the year means well over $500 per month added to the payment, with 10% down on a 30-year note. Among the hardest hit groups are first-time buyers and those looking in lower price ranges. When prices for everything from food to gasoline are also rising, higher costs for housing rates are even more difficult for many to navigate. Housing values further to translate incremental property taxes and insurance costs, which affect even those who aren't currently buying. Rents have increased sharply as well. Construction challenges and price increases for essential inputs will keep new homes pricey and discourage building lower-cost residences, which typically provide smaller profit margins. Interest rates will likely continue to rise as the Fed battles inflation and there are notable near-term headwinds. There are early signs that the market may be calming down to some degree as people give up or are priced out of the market, but unfortunately, it's unclear that relief is coming anytime soon. Stay safe. Crimes against children up in Ector County. The number of children being abused in Ector County is increasing, and not just because there was a dip due to COVID, said Carrie Brona, Executive Director of Harmony Home Children's Advocacy Center. The Texas Department of Family and Protective Services indicate the number of abuse cases investigated by Children Protective Services in Ector County dropped 10% from 2019 to 2020, but surged nearly 18% between 2020 and 2021. In looking at the difference between 2019, which was a typical year, and 2021, there was a 5% increase. The number of cases are actually even higher, Brona said. CPS doesn't track law enforcement investigations involving non-family members. Brona said the number of children reporting sexual abuse cases accounts for anywhere from 45 to 65% of the cases reported monthly. The remaining cases involve physical abuse or neglect. While child advocates expected to see a post-COVID surge once schools open back up and teachers began making reports again, Brona said, she believes the numbers are rising for other reasons as well. Social media has played a huge role, like the Me Too movement and the sexual assaults that happened with all the gymnasts. That really has opened up the world to It's not acceptable any longer, and I think it's helped. We have also started Child Safety Matters in all the schools. In 2019, Harmony Home employees began visiting students in K through 5th grade to teach them about body safety. Just under 2,400 kids received the training in 2019, but that number shot up to more than 16,000 last year. About a month ago, a little girl who spent time in the program went to school officials and told them that as a result of the program, she realized what her father was doing to her was not okay. The father was arrested, and she's now receiving therapy services with us. It starts with that education piece, and you can see that full 360. So hopefully that girl is in elementary now. When she hits adolescence, she's going to have the tools in her box that she's going to be able to cope as she develops into a young lady and know that it's not her fault, and that's what this is all about, said Brona. She believes the number of children and families reporting abuse is on the rise because of the efforts of the Ector County District Attorney's Office. It also ties back to the convictions. When people are seeing that alleged perpetrators are being found guilty and they're getting sentenced or they're having a significant consequence to their action, it allows the community to understand that there's no tolerance for that kind of behavior. It sets like a standard, you know. In my opinion, if you're going to do this, you need to be aware that there are some major consequences. It's not going to be a slap on the hand, and I feel like that has had increased and had been a good thing. Unfortunately, the number of cases being reported doesn't truly reflect the number of children being abused, Brona said. She estimates roughly 15 to 20% of parents either don't believe their children or fail to report the abuse for a variety of reasons. Parents often fear the financial implications of an arrest, are reluctant to turn in a family member, or simply would rather address the issue inside the home. 30% of children are abused in the home, and another 60% are abused by someone else they know, Brona said. Families often don't realize that Harmony Home can help them obtain social services and will provide counseling, she said. We work with these families to help them with referrals, crime victims compensation, all of the information that they need so that hopefully they can focus on the most important thing, their family becoming whole again. Not all the time does that work. I would love to say in this world that we live in, everybody becomes healed, but it's just not the world we live in, unfortunately. It saddens her that so many single parents feel compelled to invite a new boyfriend or girlfriend into their homes, whether it's for financial or any other reason, because it often doesn't occur to them the risk they are taking with their children. We had a case like that not too long ago, that gentleman who got 6 life sentences. Mom had moved into the community to have a better relationship with her parents. She was a single mom, couldn't afford daycare. A family friend was watching her. So like you know, just in reading that and understanding the concept, did the community fail her? Did the community fail that little girl? Yes. So it's one of those questions that keeps me up at night. Harmony Home is doing its best to educate people on the dangers. Since 2012, Harmony Home has been offering a 2-hour training called Darkness to Light. A trained facilitator teaches groups how to prevent, recognize, and report child sexual abuse. So far, more than 7,000 adults have gone through the program. Naturally, the Ector County District Attorney's Office is seeing a commensurate number of cases being presented to their offices for possible prosecution. However, First Assistant District Attorney Greg Barber said, sexual abuse cases are amongst the hardest to prosecute for a number of reasons. Many children don't report the incident until years after all traces of physical evidence have disappeared because they were too young, or they didn't realize they were being abused, or they were being pressured by their families not to report abuse because of finances or familial ties to the perpetrators. Getting DNA evidence from something that happened 5 years ago is probably not going to happen, If you have a girl 14 years old who says, 5 years ago, my neighbor did this, try to get people to remember where and what they were doing 5 years ago. If that suspect started saying, I was in college, I wasn't even around then, are we able to verify that? Do they have some documentation of it? The burden is on us. Are we able to put that person in proximity to our victim during that time frame? Prosecuting relatively fresh cases can also be problematic. It can be difficult when you're talking to a 4 or 5 year old. How do they look at time? You have to look at it through their eyes. Do they say it was the end of December around Christmas, or do they just remember that it was cold out and they were at their uncle's house? You have to try and find some corroboration if there's not a physical injury that's indicative of sexual assault. You have to obviously research, how can I corroborate this? Are there other witnesses or other victims out there? Investigators oftentimes have problems locating those witnesses too, Barber said. Sexual assault nurse examiners, neighbors, teachers, and other potential witnesses move over time, especially in an oil-filled time. Even when prosecutors think they might have a chance to get a guilty verdict, they often have another obstacle to overcome. The biggest problem is we have parents in some cases that do not want their children or that child to testify. They do not want them re-traumatized. A lot of times they want you to go forward with the case, but they do not want their child to have to testify sometimes. And in a very, very large percentage of them, the child would have to testify to get the evidence you needed for conviction, Barber said. So what happens is you have to weigh the victim's and parents' wishes with the ability to succeed at trial, and sometimes in between, you're looking for what's an acceptable justice among the parties. In other words, that's when prosecutors start to think about offering plea agreement. But even then, there can be issues. If a defendant doesn't have a criminal history and they're looking at 25, 50, 75 years in prison, they have no incentive to enter a plea agreement. A lot of times they're like, you're giving me pretty much a life sentence anyway, so I will take my chances at trial, Barber said. As a result, there's often a backlog of cases waiting to go to trial, he said. Activity. New state law prohibits waste near Andrews. One of State Representative Brooks Landgraf's proudest achievements during his first session as chairman of the House Environmental Regulation Committee in Austin was passage of his House Bill 7 to make it illegal for the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission to use the proposed Interim Storage Partners site 30 miles west of Andrews to dispose of high-level radioactive waste within a half-life of 24,000 years, which Landgraf and Governor Greg Abbott say could end up contaminating the Permian Basin's oil and natural gas deposits and destroying the region's economy. More broadly, the new law bans the storage and disposal of such waste anywhere within state lines. However, it allows nuclear reactors in Texas to continue operating normally, storing the waste they generate on site. Noting that the state-federal sovereignty battle is now being waged in U.S. Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals in New Orleans, Landgraf noted that Governor Greg Abbott and Congressman August Pflueger are supporting the state, with Pflueger recently having filed his own bill in Washington to vehemently oppose the dump. We're saying one thing, and the feds are saying something else, he said. The NRC has already issued a license for high-level waste to be stored near Andrews, but we're saying it would be a violation of the state law if any storage took place. He declined to predict when or how the issue will be resolved. In a brief filed February 7th with the Fifth Court by Attorney General Ken Paxton and supplemented by Abbott, the state says the NRC committed a massive breach of a January 1998 congressional directive to the U.S. Department of Energy by granting Interim Storage Partners a license to store the waste above ground in Andrews County. Interim Storage Partners was formed by Waste Control Specialists, which has operated a low-level waste repository at the site since 1995 and Orano USA, a subsidiary of the French company Orano. The brief says, in part, the NRC, which Congress tasked with ensuring the state use of radioactive materials, has reacted to the consequences of that breach by undertaking a risky, wholly unauthorized approach. Issuing a license to allow a private entity to take possession of nuclear waste and transport it from numerous locations across the entire country to an above-ground storage site in Texas, far from the reactor sites where the waste was generated. The commission claims that the license is only interim. But the license was issued for a 40-year term, is renewable, and is unaccompanied by any plan to eventually transfer the waste to a permanent repository. If the commission's plan proceeds, the odds are that this waste will be stored forever in the state of Texas. Presiding over his first committee in the spring of last year, Landgraf had served on the House Committee on Energy Resources from 2015 to 2019. The Environmental Regulation Committee also sets policy for the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality. We passed a law that modernized the Texas emissions plans through the TCEQ to apply the most innovative technology and help make the air cleaner, the 81st District Republican from Odessa said. The old emissions plan had been in place for some time, and it needed modernization. There are very few chairmanships to go around among 150 members, and I feel a lot of responsibility. Speaker Dade Phelan and I are good friends, and I'm very supportive of his speakership. Landgraf said his committee killed several Green New Deal bills that were very extreme and sought to implement proposals that would have been devastating to our own economy and jobs in the Permian Basin. I saw it as my job to thwart those bad policies and make sure that none of those bills passed out of my committee, he said. There is a wing of the Democratic Party that does not believe in the efficacy of fossil fuels and wants to eliminate them altogether. In a place like the Basin, that is our bread and butter, and those bills would have been so devastating to so many of the people I serve. You can't fool yourself into thinking we could get by on renewable energy. I believe our mission is to strike that balance between promoting a clean and safe environment and cultivating a strong economy, he said. We should ensure reasonable and predictable regulations that avoid policies seeking to regulate indirectly. We need to review and modernize policies to see that we are properly adapting to changing conditions in the environment and the economy. This is Jane, reading for the Saturday, May 14th, Odessa American. Ector County Independent School District awards Ramirez as Nutrition Employee of the Year. With a signature smile on her face, Lucia Ramirez was awarded with the School Nutrition Employee of the Year at Permian High School on Friday. She was surprised with a placard, an award, and a check from the Education Foundation to mark the occasion. Officials from Permian High School and across the district, including Superintendent Scott Murray, gathered around her. The district did the same at campuses around the district Friday and awarded others May 6th at another group of schools. Former Director of School Nutrition and now Executive Director of Operations, Brandon Reyes, said Ramirez is very deserving of this recognition. She puts out a ton of effort every day and her smile is contagious. She remains positive even amidst all the craziness, he said. Ramirez has said she has been at Permian for 11 years. This has made me so happy. I love my job and I try to do the best every day, she added. Ramirez said she likes to work in the schools because she tries to help students and every day is different. A mother of three, she added that she tries to treat students like one of her own children. I love to cook, she said. She added that she tastes everything to make sure it's okay. The students seem to like pizza and chicken nuggets best. Juan Pando, Director of School Nutrition Services, said she thinks it's great that Ramirez received the laurel. She's a reliable employee that we can always count on to come to work every day. She prepares over 1,000 meals a day, which is not an easy job, but she does it with a smile on her face and such a positive attitude. Pando added that Ramirez attitude is infectious and prompts others to push up their production. Nancy Cook, a school nutrition supervisor and formerly PHS school nutrition manager, nominated Ramirez for the award, and Pondo chose her out of four nominees. "She's amazing, totally amazing," Cook said. Janet Bell, also a supervisor, was also at Permian High School. She said Ramirez has undergone immense hardships this year, but still came to work with a smile on her face. "She laughs at everything. She's a happy person, even through all of it," Cook said. In addition to her work at Permian High School, she also dances in a ballet.
We've been reading from the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. Please stay tuned for the weather, followed by the second hour's reading of the newspapers.